From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There are a lot of questions today about what may be the biggest blunder in the history of the Academy Awards.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
La La Land.
Well, we would soon find out why Warren Beatty was pausing for so long. After he and Faye Dunaway announced that La La Land had won Best Picture, the cast from that film took the stage and started giving their acceptance speeches, and then this happened.
Guys, I'm sorry.
No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won. Come on, this is not a joke.
I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
Jordan Horowitz, the producer of La La Land, there, he had just given his acceptance speech when he was told that the presenters had opened the wrong envelope and it was Moonlight that had actually won. So how did such a big mistake happen at one of the most watched events of the year? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us as he does each week from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this is just unbelievable. Now, PricewaterhouseCoopers is the accounting firm that counts the Oscar ballots and hold on to those envelopes. What are they saying happened?
I mean, I'm still catching my breath, and I was already breathless. I mean, think about the year we've had. The Warriors were up 3-1. Clinton was 99% to win in several poll estimates. The Falcons were 99% to win the Super Bowl. Beyonce was supposed to win the Grammys. Right. Can anything end normally anymore? Right. It's like we're stuck in this reality simulator directed by M. Night Shyamalan. It's incredible. Okay, so here's what we know. We know that PwC has two copies of each Oscars envelope. We know that one copy of the Best Actress envelope was handed from Leonardo DiCaprio to Emma Stone, the Best Actress winner. We know that an envelope labeled Best Actress in a Leading Role, presumably the second such envelope, ended up in Warren Beatty's hands. Accounting firms are celebrated for their redundancies, but what seems to have happened here is that the redundancy itself is what led to this just unbelievably unlikely catastrophe for the award ceremony.
Well, and you can see that Warren Beatty, there's something going on. He knows that something is wrong here. I guess in the midst of a crowd of the most famous people in Hollywood, maybe you just get nervous and you don't want to say anything, or he wanted the producers to come in and fix it. I still wonder why Faye Dunaway just said La La Land.
I know. Last night, I was going through all of these YouTube videos like they were like the Zapruder film or something, like with JFK. I mean, think about all the things that had to go perfectly wrong for this to happen. One, he had to get the wrong card. Two, the movie on the card had to be nominated for Best Picture. It had to be a plausible winner. Emma Stone was the only nominee in her category who appeared in a Best Picture nominee. Mm. He had to have a second person standing by with him who would mistakenly just read the name of the movie rather than the actress. You needed so many different things to go perfectly wrong for La La Land to be announced. It just boggles the mind. It is unbelievable that it happened.
And here's something even more unbelievable. It wasn't even the only flub in the Oscars in this way. There was the Oscars In Memoriam video, and they put up a photo of someone who wasn't dead.
Yeah, that's right. The video showed the name of a costume designer, Janet Patterson, who passed away, in October. But next to Patterson's name, the screen showed a picture of a film producer, Jan Chapman, who is very much alive and has worked with the late Janet Patterson. And so I believe that Jan Chapman, soon after seeing her face in the In Memoriam section, tweeted out to her friends and family, I'm very much alive. I'm not dead. But sadly, sadly, the person whose name is next to my face is my dear friend who just passed away.
Well, you know, as Jimmy Kimmel pointed out, it's just an award show. So, you know, it could be a lot worse. But, you know, I wonder what it says that somebody can make a mistake like that at such a crucial moment in a show that is watched by many millions. And then I was thinking about other examples of things like this. And one is what just happened at Columbia University, which sent around 300 applicants incorrect acceptance letters saying that they had gotten in when in fact they hadn't, and then had to go back and say, no, you weren't accepted to Columbia.
That's right. Your first point is really important. I mean, as we're laughing and having fun talking about a flub at the Oscars, it's a flub at the Oscars. This is not exactly the most important thing in the world. But yeah, this actually happens all the time, really, with college acceptance letters. Almost every single year, certainly every few years, there's at least one college that accidentally sends out hundreds of acceptance letters and then has to immediately rescind those after a few hours or a few days. A much more meaningful moment, one would think, you know, at the beginning of these young people's lives. The other event that this reminded me of in the sports world. There's the famous the play from the 1982 college football game. This is the famous call. The band is on the field. The band is on the field. That is the closest thing that I can remember to such a momentous flub, a last-minute flub in an entertainment spectacle.
Well,
game. People
make mistakes. Derek Thompson, a senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Well, from Oscars to foreign policy, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been on the job for almost a month. In that time, he's only made a few brief public statements, and the State Department has not given a news briefing under the new administration. For more on the State Department under Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump, we're joined now by NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, nice to be here, Eric.
Thanks for coming in. Secretary of State Tillerson has kept a pretty low profile so far, you'd have to say, both at home and on his overseas trips. I mean, he hasn't given interviews. He's barely spoken publicly. That's prompted some editorials that he's been sidelined. You asked former Bush National Security Advisor Steve Hadley about that issue the other day, and here's what he said.
My sources tell me that Tillerson meets with the president a lot and that he is winning the trust of the president, which is good. I have a lot of confidence in Tillerson. He's a strong individual. He is not going to be sidelined in this new administration.
I mean, we should say Hadley is a supporter of Tillerson. But, Michelle, I mean, what are you hearing? Has Tillerson been marginalized?
Well, he's certainly keeping a low profile. But remember, too, Eric, that this has been a time of some upheaval in the White House. They had to swap the national security advisors after Michael Flynn resigned for misleading the vice president over contacts with Russia. Also, remember that Tillerson is new to Washington. He's a former ExxonMobil CEO, one of Hadley's clients, by the way. That's their connection. He's been running a vast company that's well known for its secrecy. It's a company where he spent his entire career. So he certainly needs some time to figure out how he fits in here and what it means to be the Secretary of State.
So some of it clearly the transition sort of growing pains, but he's also been missing, Michelle, from some key White House meetings with foreign leaders, including Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Isn't that unusual?
It is very unusual. Tillerson did have dinner with the Israeli prime minister the night before Benjamin Netanyahu went on to the White House, but he also wasn't in the meeting with Japan's prime minister, with Canada's prime minister. And, you know, the one key player that has been in a lot of these meetings is Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president. So there's also, different power centers here dealing with foreign policy. And I have to say that countries have taken notice. While Tillerson and other cabinet officials have been spending a lot of time reassuring allies and partners about some of the things Trump has said or tweeted, those allies are also reaching out separately to people like Jared Kushner and even to Steve Bannon.
Yeah, there is a perception out there that there are these now factions within the White House. What about the media? I mean, the State Department news briefings, as you well know, is part of how reporters find out about the big issues, how they press the administration on foreign policy. I mean, why haven't they been holding these regular briefings?
Well, it's also a chance for the State Department to explain itself and explain policies to the world. It's not even just about a gift to us in any way. Mm-hmm. It's an important public diplomacy tool, and they haven't had a single briefing since Trump was inaugurated. It is very unusual. Career Foreign Service officers at the State Department's press office usually keep these going even, through these transitions until a new spokesperson is named. I mean, part of this is really that, they're not really sure how to explain U.S. policies. There's a lot under review right now. We're told they're going to start having briefings again next week. Might not be as frequent. We'll have to see.
Interesting. Now, more than 1,000 State Department employees, Michelle, signed this dissent memo that you reported on objecting to Trump's travel ban. And the White House press secretary is also said that basically, those state employees who don't want to get with the Trump program, should resign. What are you hearing about morale at the State Department, given all that's going on?
Well, there's a lot of unease, obviously. But when Tillerson first arrived, he did give some very a positive first impression in a brief address to the staff. I'm also told that he made a good impression in his meetings privately, talking about the dissent channel and how important that is to have that kind of supposed to be an internal dialogue, not a leaking to the press external dialogue, but at least that he's listening to the concerns of the department. But at the same time, they've been pushing out a lot of even career diplomats. You know, usually there's a period of transition where there's a lot of people leaving and some coming. Here we've seen mainly people departing.
Interesting turnover and confusion at the State Department. Thanks for shedding some light on it. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the little-noticed headlines from the Trump administration last week was a reversal of an Obama directive to end the use of private prisons. For-profit prisons are a $5 billion industry, and critics say they lack transparency, accountability, and have no incentives to reduce recidivism. The Obama administration said private prisons aren't as safe as government-run facilities. Nonetheless, the Trump administration has reversed the order, which means the federal government will continue to use them. Joining us now is Lauren Brooke Eisen, who is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, what do you think of this reversal from the Trump administration?
Well, it is an interesting reversal, but it's one that a lot of analysts and people who cover the industry had predicted would happen. Interestingly enough, with the Attorney General Sessions guidance to the Bureau of Prisons last week, it was a very short memo. Attorney General Sessions gave very little explanation as to why they were reversing course on this guidance.
Well, so you say it's not a surprise. Why isn't it a surprise? Why does the Trump administration want to use more private prisons?
Well, the new administration has called for a crackdown on what they falsely see as a rise in crime. And, you know, this is sort of a harbinger of things to come. It's an indication that Attorney General Sessions and the administration might be concerned about running out of available bed space in the Federal Bureau of Prisons facilities. One of the reasons why, and one of the most compelling reasons, that the Obama administration decided to start to phase out its reliance on these private prisons is because the BOP population had started to decline.
The BOP, the Bureau of Prisons. So these are the government-run prisons.
Exactly. So the number of people in federal prison has decreased over the last couple of years. And because of this decrease, the Justice Department decided that it didn't need to rely on these private prisons. And that makes sense. That's why one would contract with private prisons in the first place, is to provide this extra bed capacity. But when you no longer need that bed capacity, that's the time when you should start to phase out those contracts.
I also wonder how much of a lobbying effort there has been on the part of private prisons, because when the Obama directive came down, their stocks went down. And since Trump has been elected, their stocks have been going up. They must want more use of private prisons. Did they lobby effectively on their behalf?
Well, as of last Friday, the stocks of GEO Group and CoreCivic, the two largest private prison corporations in the United States, had seen a 100% increase in their stocks since the election. So we've seen a huge uptick in share prices. GEO Group and CoreCivic have each given about $250,000 to support Trump's inauguration events, and the GEO Group, through its own political action committee, had also given some funding to the campaign of Donald Trump as well.
How many inmates are currently serving time in private prisons?
So there are almost 190,000 inmates in federal prison today. But if we zoom out and look at the entire prison population of the United States, we have about 8% of the state and federal prison population behind bars in private prisons. So to break it down in terms of numbers, it's about 126,000 inmates that are held in private prison facilities. But that number is also a little bit conservative, because it doesn't account for the approximately 8,000 to 10,000 people who are held in private immigration detention facilities.
What's the difference in a cost per prisoner for the government at a federally owned prison versus a private prison?
So again, that it depends on how you look at the data. There's marginal costs and incremental costs. So when you look at the cost of a prison, it becomes a little bit complicated because you're really only saving money when you close down a wing of a prison, close down a prison, or reduce the number of staff. And so federal prisons are usually a little bit more expensive than in state prisons just because there tends to be a little bit more security. But again, those costs tend to be different from prison to prison.
And there's not a wild range between a private prison and a government-run prison?
There's not. And what happens is if you're looking at a state contract, you know, the states basically pay the private prison operator to house the inmates, and it's all in the contract. Where it can get tricky and where a lot of people who sort of are adamant that private prisons shouldn't exist is, you know, these inherent conflicts of interests when the corporations are actually paid sort of a set amount no matter how many people are in their facilities. And so, you know, what that does is it ensures that the private prison operator is paid even if the prison is not full.
And are the people held in private prisons treated notably differently than people held in government-run prisons?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I'm writing a book on private prisons called Inside Private Prisons, and it's one of the questions that I explore in the book. It's a complicated question. The Inspector General's Office of the DOJ last August issued a report indicating that private prisons at the federal level simply do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources, and they do not maintain the same level of safety and security that government-run prisons do. Now, that's looking just at the federal level. There have also been a lot of lawsuits filed, a lot of allegations about what happens in private prisons at the state level, but that also happens in state-run prisons. There are, you know, Rikers Island is a jail in New York City, and that has certainly come under a lot of scrutiny for, allegations of rape and sexual assault and, unhygienic living conditions. So the point is that it's a very hard question to answer whether one is better off in a state-run prison or a privately run or operated prison. But at the end of the day, what we really need to look at is outcomes and how we can improve public and private prisons so that recidivism rates are reduced and so that we ensure that those who do spend their time behind bars in private prisons are being treated well, are receiving the same services, if not better services, than they would receive at a state-run prison. And so it's a little bit of a mixed bag. And what I found, in my interviews with inmates is even those who had, whose time behind bars in a private prison might have been better than their time in a state prison. At the end of the day, most of them say, but when I think that someone's making money off of me, that breaks my heart.
Well, who does a better job at making sure that inmates do not reoffend after they get out? Is it private prisons or the government-run facilities?
So the recidivism rate nationwide is pretty high. It's between 40 to 60%. So that indicates that the nation as a whole, public corrections are not doing a great job at making sure that the people who leave their prisons and jails are not returning. And that's something that corrections across the country needs to work on. And when we look at private prisons, the data is very, very difficult to come by because what happens in practicality is you might spend a year in a state prison. Then you might go to a private prison for 6 months or a year, and then you might finish out your programming or your reentry programming in a state-run facility before you're released. So it's very hard to track that recidivism data, but that's something that we as a country really need to get better at tracking.
Well, I know that Australia has used private prisons, but one of the things that they've done is incentivize those private prisons to keep prisoners from reoffending by offering a bonus to the companies that own the prisons if prisoners do not come out and reoffend. Does the U.S. do that?
That's something that's fairly new. So Australia, in fact, has two new private prison contracts where they incentivize a reduction in recidivism rates through bonuses paid to these companies. And those are very new contracts, so we don't know what the results are. But we've seen some positive results in the Peterborough prison in the UK and in halfway house contracts with the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania, where Pennsylvania has provided bonuses to private halfway house providers who can reduce recidivism rates and beat the state's recidivism benchmark.
So as you look at what's now going to happen and an increase in the use of private prisons by the federal government, what would be the one piece of advice you would give the Trump administration as they move in this direction, which is different than what the Obama administration had hoped for?
I think that the Trump administration should look long and hard at every prison they contract with and look at the record of that prison, look at the safety and security levels, look at the level of correctional services that they provided or didn't provide. Additionally, it's incredibly important that the federal government restructure these contracts to ensure that private prison operators are focusing on reducing recidivism, improving outcomes for the 2.3 million people who are incarcerated. It's really important that we restructure these contracts around the nation's public policy goals, which at the end of the day is to reduce recidivism and improve public safety.
That's Lauren Brooke Eisen, who is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice, and her forthcoming book, which she mentioned, is called Inside Private Prisons. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Billionaire Warren Buffett held up his flip phone during an interview with CNBC Today. He said he doesn't own an iPhone, but that didn't stop him from more than doubling down his company's investment in Apple since the new year. Buffett said this morning he's noticed how useful customers find Apple's top product.
It just has that quality that it gets built into their lives. Now, that doesn't mean something can't come along that will disrupt it, but the continuity of the product is huge.
Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So the news from Warren Buffett means that Apple is now one of Berkshire Hathaway's biggest equity holdings. Put this in a little context for us. What's the big deal?
Well, you know, Buffett has not been a huge fan of technology companies, and maybe he doesn't even see it as a technology company. Maybe he just says, hey, this is just producing a fantastic product. But it's really interesting in this particular letter where he mentions Apple and also investments in some airlines. He'd been previously quite dismissive of airlines. So he's adding some new types of asset classes, industries into his asset class of stocks and doing quite well. Thank you very much.
Well, and today's interview comes after he released his annual letter to shareholders over the weekend, and he had some damning words for the hedge fund industry. Tell us what he said.
Well, first of all, I mean, this is just fabulous because in my mind, he's sort of this truth teller and he has such, authenticity. And he says that the fee system around hedge funds, where they charge 2% a year and 20% of the profits, he says it, quote, borders on obscene. And he says that it's going to make that fee structure certainly makes a lot of people rich, but it's not investors who are getting rich. It's the folks who are running those hedge funds. You know, there have been a great bet that Warren Buffett has with a hedge fund guy. And he said, hey, look, I'll bet you that if I invest in an index fund, it'll be your best five hedge funds over the 10-year period. Guess what? He's right. When he looked at the performance right now, we're almost up to 10 years through 2016. The hedge funds, 2.2% annually. The index fund, 7.1%.
Interesting. And he predicts that pension funds, or says pension funds and other investors, have lost some $100 billion in the last decade because of those high fees. I mean, what is he telling people to do with their money instead, Joe?
Well, look, he's saying you could invest in me, Warren Buffett, right? You could buy Berkshire Hathaway. Or for most people, and I think he believes 99% of investors, that you can use an index fund or a portfolio of index funds to help you manage your financial life. And, you know, what's interesting is this shift is taking place already. We know that most investors previously had said, oh, I'm going to go out and buy a managed mutual fund. They know something better. But the evidence has been really sketchy that over the long term, passive investing with index funds tends to do better than trying to beat the index because it's cheaper. And we know that last year, $342 billion moved out of actively managed funds. $505 billion went into passively managed funds. So people are listening to Buffett and obviously reading the results of real research.
Jill, briefly, you know, is the hedge fund industry making any effort to lower their big fees?
Yeah, I mean, look, they have made some changes, but I think the biggest change in the hedge fund industry is so many are shutting down. And we hear this every day. That is simply because they can't compete on the fee structure, and they're really having a hard time delivering results.
Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much for joining us.
Take care.
President Trump signed an executive order earlier this month calling for rules laid out in the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 to be reviewed and rolled back. The law was put in place to stop another financial crisis from happening, and there are concerns about efforts to weaken it, including from Michael Barr, a key architect of Dodd-Frank at the Treasury Department who now teaches at the University of Michigan. Michael Barr, welcome. And do you think the momentum is building to dismantle Dodd-Frank?
Well, I'm quite worried that the direction that the new administration is planning to take will bring us back to the very practices that caused the financial crisis in 2008, and that was so devastating to American households and businesses, that cost us millions of jobs and crushed our economy and really hurt the global economy in a way that it is still recovering from. So I'm quite concerned about the direction they're heading.
Where do you think the push is coming from to dismantle Dodd-Frank?
Well, it's coming from a mix of sources. First of all, many in the financial sector never gave up the fight after Dodd-Frank. They kept trying to litigate against it, to lobby against it. And so in one sense, this is just a continuation of a long fight.
Because they're not making as much money as they used to? Because it does seem like the banks on Wall Street are doing fine right now, aren't they?
I think the U.S. financial system is extremely healthy. It's strong. The banks are making a lot of money. And more importantly, for the rest of us, they're lending to the economy, which is what you want them to do. So I don't think it makes any sense as an economic matter to roll back these kinds of reforms.
What are the most important pieces of Dodd-Frank, in your view, the things that really shouldn't go away?
Well, first of all, the Republicans in Congress and many other financial sector folks have been trying to gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And I think that would be a horrible mistake. Because the consumer agency really has been helping American families. It's saved over $12 billion in fees and other illegal activity and returned those funds to the American people. The second big area, I'd say, is the ability to regulate big Wall Street firms, firms like AIG that helped cause the financial crisis. The administration is talking about stopping the government's ability to regulate those non-bank firms. I think that would be a big mistake. The third area that they're going after is the orderly liquidation authority. This is kind of technical, but it's the way that the government would wind down a firm like Lehman Brothers if it got into distress in the future, rather than sending it into bankruptcy, which would blow up the economy, or bailing it out, which nobody wants to see ever again. And I'd say another big area of reform that they've been targeting is derivatives reform. This is the kind of activity that AIG and others were engaged in that helped accelerate the financial crisis. They're talking about rolling back those reforms.
Well, another one that has come up is the Volcker Rule, which stops banks from basically making bets with their own money. Do you think that is important to keep?
I do think it's important to keep. I think that one of the key areas of reform was trying to build a better structural separation between different parts of the financial sector. To help prevent a kind of quick transmission of risk from one part to another.
One of the arguments that I'm sure will come up is that we've got to get rid of some of these regulations because we're in an international playing field here in the world of finance, and other countries don't have regulations that are as strict as ours.
I think that argument is exactly backwards. If you look at the set of reforms that have been going on since the financial crisis, the U.S. and other regulators around the world have been working closely together to try and generate a level playing field with high standards. And you see that in the U.S. and you see it in Europe. And I think that that makes all of our economies both safer and also better able to lend and engage in productive activity.
President Trump has said that regulations are making it hard for businesses to borrow money. Let's listen.
We expect to be cutting a lot out of Dodd-Frank because, frankly, I have so many people, friends of mine, that have nice businesses. They can't borrow money. They just can't get any money because the banks just won't let them borrow.
Do you buy that people are having a difficult time borrowing money because of Dodd-Frank?
I don't think that's true at all. It's not borne out by the evidence. And I think it was quite striking that the president referred to his friends not being able to get loans. That's not what this is about. This is about making the financial system work for the American economy, for American households as a whole, for American businesses as a whole, not for the president's friends. And if you look at the broad measures of economic activity, if you look at the measures of lending in the economy, lending has been going up year after year since the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act. It's been growing faster than the economic growth of the country as a whole. It's strong. The basic argument that we need to roll back reforms to get more lending doesn't make any sense.
Michael Barr, the political reality is that Dodd-Frank is probably going to be revised in some way just because Trump won the election and the Republicans control Congress right now, and many of them don't like this law. Are there ways that you would say it could be revised without getting rid of it or without undoing some of the most important things in it?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me just say the extent of rollback is a function of whether the American people pushes back. And I think if people get engaged, if people resist these kinds of reforms that will make the system much less safe and much less fair, I think we have a chance of preventing the worst harms.
But how do you win that battle? How do you get people engaged on an issue like financial reform that is so complicated? Once you start saying the word derivatives, you know, people have already been lost.
Well, I think there are many elements people can understand. I mean, first of all, the first rollback that the Republicans undertook was this measure that now lets oil companies make secret payments to foreign governments. I think anybody can understand that doing that is not in the interest of American households. Or if you look at consumer protection, they've been talking about firing Richard Cordray, who has just been an absolutely outstanding director for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And they're talking about weakening that agency that helps people protect themselves against abuses in the mortgage market or from debt collectors or credit card companies. I think people can understand that. I don't envy the Trump administration trying to sneak this past the American people.
So back to my question, what would you revise in Dodd-Frank?
Well, I think in terms of Dodd-Frank itself, there are always technical measures that you could do to make it work better. And I think in particular for the very smallest banks, community banks, there are ways of clarifying and protecting them from the additional burden, not just of the Dodd-Frank Act, but more broadly of bank regulation, of Know Your Customer rules, of Bank Secrecy Act provisions. There are measures you could take that are very targeted that make sure that the very smallest banks in our economy can continue to thrive. And that's where I would focus energy, not on regional banks, not on very large banks, not on derivatives regulation, not on liquidation authority, and certainly not on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Do you think that if Dodd-Frank is pulled back dramatically, that we're at risk for another financial crisis quickly?
Look, I don't think that it's easy to predict the future in any respect, and I certainly think we ought to be humble about the ability to predict the next financial crisis. But what I will say is this: rolling back Dodd-Frank will set the conditions for whenever the next financial crisis comes. And if they succeed in rolling back Dodd-Frank to the extent they're talking about, they will make that financial crisis much more likely to come and much more severe and brutal in its consequences if it does come.
What does it tell you that after the Great Depression, the financial changes that went into effect lasted for decades, and here we are just a decade or less after the financial crisis, and already people are trying to get rid of the rules that were put in place after the financial crisis?
I do think there's a kind of collective amnesia that's descended on Washington, where people either forget or they're paid to forget the causes and consequences of the financial crisis. And I think that's horrible for the economy. It's horrible for the American people. But I think if you go back and look at the reforms in the 30s and 40s in the wake of the Great Depression, people were fighting against those too. And it took concerted action by the American people to say, no, that's not the kind of country we want to live in. And I think we have to see the same thing now.
That's Michael Barr, who was the U.S. Department of Treasury's Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions and was a key architect of the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. He's now a professor of law and public policy at the University of Michigan. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
On the coast of Northern California, 2 years of unusually warm water have wreaked havoc on the marine ecosystem. These fragile underwater kelp forests that stretch from the Bay Area all the way to the Oregon border have shrunk by more than 90% since 2008. And the crisis has led to a surprising alliance between fishermen and regulators. Eli Wirtschafter of Here and Now contributor KQED explains.
Well, there you go. Now,
John Holcomb is a fisherman with the leathery skin of a guy who spends a lot of time out on his boat.
When we leave the harbor, we'll be entering fog, so I'll turn the radar on.
For 42 years, Holcomb has made his living as a diver. He sells red urchins. Their buttery insides are a popular menu item in Japanese restaurants. Holcomb takes me to a peaceful cove near the town of Mendocino, where he used to dive for urchins.
This was solid kelp when we first came here in the mid-80s. This was a complete mat you couldn't swim through.
Now he squints across the water and sees something very different.
Well, it's devoid of kelp. It's like a lake.
That's bad for fishermen like Holcomb because urchins feed on kelp. In the last 2 years, the local red urchin harvest has plummeted by 90%.
Without kelp, you'll lose all your shell fishery. You'll lose the abalone fishery. You'll lose the urchin fishery.
In the middle of all this dying, there's one species that's taken over. Purple urchins. They're an especially tough variety of urchin that can survive with very little food.
They just keep breeding, and there's more and more of them each year.
Right now, the balance has tipped over too far towards the purple urchins.
They'll eat all the new kelp that wants to grow, and it's a plague, really.
I have a friend who calls them the goats of the sea.
That's Cynthia Catton, a marine biologist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
They form these feeding fronts and they just munch all the way through everywhere they're walking.
So what started the purple urchin's kelp-eating rampage? Well, 3 years ago, sea stars all along the coast were nearly wiped out by a gruesome wasting disease.
This is important because the sea stars, many of those sea stars, were one of our most important predators of urchins.
Sea stars died, so urchin populations exploded. The urchins ate lots of kelp. And then there was another problem. Kelp need cold water. And since 2014, the northern Pacific Ocean had been unusually warm. Last year's El Nino made the water even warmer.
The kelp forest has just kind of gotten it from all sides.
So, Catton met up with a bunch of local divers. Now, divers sometimes don't get along with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which limits how much they can fish. But both groups see what's happened to the kelp forest, and they have a common goal, to bring it back. So they came up with an experiment to remove purple urchins at a few test sites along the coast. Back on his boat near Mendocino, fisherman John Holcomb is assembling a kind of homemade underwater vacuum cleaner. He slaps together 10-foot-long pieces of fiberglass tubing.
Not real pretty.
The tube connects to an air pump on deck. Holcomb gears up and gets to work. Now, I couldn't go underwater with Holcomb to watch him, but he's made videos where you can see and hear what he does next. His video shows the seafloor about 30 feet under. It looks like a minefield of spiky purple creatures. Using a little metal rake, Holcomb scrapes the urchins off the rocks with a tube, which sucks them into a huge net. On the dam with him, it takes him almost 2 hours to clear off an area smaller than a tennis court. He finally comes up, and his net is packed with thousands of purple urchins with wiggly spines. But Holcomb won't make a penny selling these urchins as food.
We'll smash it for you so you get an idea of what the problem is. If this was a regular urchin that was eating kelp, you'd see nice fat pieces of roe there.
Instead, it's a nearly empty shell. Even after eating all the kelp they can find, these urchins are starving. We head back to a dock in Fort Bragg, where Cynthia Catton, the fish and wildlife biologist, has brought a bunch of local volunteers to count and measure the urchins.
2-3, 2-3, 2-4, 2-4, 3-6, 3-6.
Catton is keeping careful records. She needs to know just how many urchins Holcomb could remove with his vacuum cleaner device. A few months from now, she'll see whether the kelp has grown back in the spot where he was diving. And then they can decide whether to continue the experiment. Holcomb says he'll do whatever it takes, but...
It's much like trying to scratch the paint off a house with a pin. It's not going to be easy.
But there have been a few changes in the ocean that may be a good sign for the kelp. Recent storms have cooled off the ocean, and temperatures are closer to normal. And another thing, scientists have found a surprising number of baby sea stars up and down the coast. Sea stars that could help bring back the balance of the ecosystem by eating the urchins that have been eating the kelp. For Here and Now, I'm Eli Wirtschafter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.